I am here with Paul Bloom. Paul, thanks for joining me.
Sam, it's good to talk to you, as always.
Yeah, great to see you. It's been, we were just talking off mic. It was, it's been years. It's crazy how that happens, but it has been.
I've been following you, though. You've been doing well.
Yeah, nice. Yeah, well, I've been following you. I've read you in the New Yorker recently, writing about AI. I think you've written at least two articles there since we actually wrote a joint article for the New York Times 7 years ago, if you can believe that.
Oh, yeah.
About Westworld and the philosophical import of watching it and realizing that only a psychopath could go to such a theme park and rape Dolores and kill children, et cetera. I think we predicted no such theme park will ever exist because it'll be a bug light for psychopaths and normal people will come back. And if they do anything like that, they'll scandalize their friends and loved ones and be treated like psychopaths appropriately.
We'll see. We may be proven wrong. Who knows in this crazy time. But that was a fun article to write. And I think we wrestled with the dilemmas of dealing with, you know, entities that at least appear to be conscious. And the moral struggles that leads to.
Yeah. Well, I think we'll start with AI, but remind people what you're doing and what kinds of problems you focus on. I think though we haven't spoken for several years, I think you still probably hold the title of most repeat podcast guest at this point. I haven't counted the episodes, but you've been on a bunch, but it's been a while. So remind people what you focus on as a psychologist.
Yeah, I'm a psychology professor. I have positions at Yale, but I'm located at University of Toronto, and I study largely moral psychology. But I'm interested in development, in issues of consciousness, issues of learning, notions of fairness and kindness, compassion, empathy. I've actually been thinking, it's funny to be talking to you because my newest project, which I've just been getting excited by, has to do with the origins of morality. Mm-hmm. And the spark was a podcast with you talking to Tom Holland, author of Dominion.
Oh, nice. How so? What was the actual spark?
Yeah, I found this a great conversation. He made the case that a lot of the sort of morality that maybe you and I would agree with, that you know, the idea of respecting the right to universal rights and a morality that isn't based on the powerful, but instead maybe in some way respects the weak, mm-hmm. is not the product of rational thought, not the product of secular reasoning, but instead the product of Christianity. And he makes this argument in Dominion and several other places.
Yeah.
And I've been thinking about it. I mean, I think it's a serious point. He's not the only one to make it. It deserves consideration, but I think it's mistaken.
Yeah.
I think my next project, as I've been thinking about it, and so I thank you for the podcast getting me going on this, mm-hmm. is to make the alternative case, to argue that a lot of our morality is inborn and innate. I'm a developmental psychologist, that's part of what I do. And a lot of morality is a product of reasoned and rational thought. I don't deny that culture plays a role, including Christianity, but yeah. I don't think that's the big story.
Nice. Well, I look forward to you making that argument because that's one of these shibboleths of organized religion that I think needs to be retired. And so you're just the guy to do it. So
thank you.
Let me know when you produce that book and we'll talk about it.
I mean, I got to say, I heard you guys talk and you sort of, you know, you guys engaged properly on the idea and Holland, I've never met, but he seems like a really smart and quite a scholar. So it's not a, you know, and he gets, I think, credence by the fact that he's in some way arguing against his own side. He himself isn't a devout Christian, a secular.
Yeah.
But that doesn't make him right. So I'm very interested in engaging these ideas.
So how have you been thinking about AI of late? What has surprised you in the 7 years since we first started talking about it?
A mixture of awe and horror. I'm not a doomer. I'm not as much of a doomer as some people. I don't know when the last time I checked with you, Sam. What would you say your p-doom is?
I've never actually quantified it for myself, but
now's your time.
I think it's non-negligible. I mean, it's very hard for me to imagine it actually occurring in the most spectacularly bad way of, you know, a very fast takeoff, you know, an intelligence explosion that ruins everything almost immediately. But, you know, fast or slow, I think it's well worth worrying about because I don't think the probability is tiny. I mean, I would put it in double digits. I don't know what those double digits are, but I wouldn't put it in single digits given the kind of the logic of the situation.
I think we're kind of in the same place.
Yeah.
I mean, people always talk about, you know, you have a benevolent, superintelligent AI and you tell it to make paperclips and it destroys the world and turns us all into paperclips. But there's another vision of malevolent AI I've been thinking about with the rise of what's it called, Mech Hitler.
Mecha Hitler.
Yeah. You know, yeah. So, you know, it's a simpler scenario. Some deranged billionaire creates an AI that fashions itself on Hitler. The Trump Defense Department purchases it and gets it, connects it to all of his weaponry systems, and hijinks ensue.
How could you come up with such an outlandish scenario that could never happen? There's just no way.
It's a bizarre fantasy. Yeah. And by the way, it also makes porn.
So just to
get the trifecta.
Yeah.
So anyway, I'm like a lot of people, I worry about that. I also find at the same time, I find AI an increasingly indispensable part of my intellectual life.
Oh, interesting.
I have a question, but not just a specific one. I use it as a substitute for Google. I say, where's a good Indonesian restaurant in my neighborhood? And, you know, how do you convert these euros into dollars? But I also have a question like, I don't know. I got into an argument with somebody about revenge. So what's the cross-cultural evidence for revenge being a universal, and who would argue against that? And 3 seconds later, boom, bunch of papers, books, thoughtful discussion, thoughtful argument. Mixed in are hallucinations. Occasionally I find it cites a paper written by me that I've never written. But it's astonishing.
I've been credited with things. It's told me I've interviewed people I've never interviewed. And it's amazingly apologetic when you correct it. But
I'm so sorry. Yes, you are totally right. Let me now give you citations of papers that actually exist.
Yeah.
In your working day, when you write, when you prepare for interviews, how much do you use it?
Well, I've just started experimenting with it in a way that's probably not the usual use case. So we have fed everything I've written and everything I've said on the podcast into ChatGPT, right?
And Mac Harris.
Yeah. So we have two things. We have we've created a chat bot that is me, that's model agnostic. So it can be run on ChatGPT or a Claude or whatever the best model is. You can swap in whatever model seems best. But so this is like at the, you know, a layer above at the system prompt level. And it has, again, access to everything. It's something like 12 million words of me, right? So it's a lot. That would be a lot of books. We've just begun playing with this thing, but it's impressive because it also is using a professional voice clone. So it sounds like me and it's every bit as monotonous as me in its delivery. I mean, so I'm almost tailor-made to be cloned because I already speak like a robot.
Must be agonizing to listen to Sam.
But it hallucinates and it's capable of being weird. So I don't know that we're ever going to unleash this thing on the world, but it's interesting because it even having access to every episode of my podcast, it still will hallucinate an interview that never happened. You know, it'll still tell me that I interviewed somebody that I never interviewed. And so it's, that part's still strange, but presumably the, this is as bad as it'll ever be. And the general models will get better and better, one imagines. So
we're looking at each other on video, and I imagine it doesn't do video yet, but if we were talking on the phone or without video, would I be able to tell quickly that I was talking to an AI and not to you?
Only because it would be able to produce far more coherent and comprehensive responses to any question. I mean, if you said, because it's hooked up to whatever the best LLM is at the moment, you know, if you said, give me 17 points as to the cause of the Great Depression, it would give you exactly 17 points detailing the cause of the Great Depression. And I could not do that. So it would fail the Turing test, as all these LLMs do, by passing it so spectacularly and instantaneously. Yeah. That's a surprise. I want to ask you about that. That's a surprise for me how not a thing the Turing test turned out to be. It's like the Turing test was the staple of the cognitive science literature and just our imaginings in advance of credible AI. We just thought, okay, there's going to be this moment where we're just not going to be able to tell whether it's a human or whether it's a bot, and that's going to be somehow philosophically important and culturally interesting. But, you know, overnight we were given LLMs that fail the Turing test because of how well they pass it.
Yeah.
And this is no longer a thing. It's like, it was never a Turing test moment that I caught.
All of a sudden, you and I have a super intelligent being I talk to on my iPhone. And I'll be honest, and I think other psychologists should be honest about it. If you had asked me a month before this thing came out, how far away we were from such a machine, I would say 10, 20, 30 years, maybe 100 years.
Right.
And now we have it. Now we have a machine we could talk to and sounds like a person. And except, like you say, it's just a lot smarter.
Yeah.
And it is mind-boggling. It's an interesting psychological fact how quickly we get used to it. It's as if, you know, aliens landed, you know, next to the Washington Monument, and now they walk among us. Oh, yeah. Well, that's the way things go.
Yeah.
Oh, you developed teleporters. Now we got teleporters. And we just take it for granted now.
Yeah. Well, so now what are your thoughts about the implications, you know, psychological and otherwise, of AI companionship? I mean, at the time we're recording this, there's been recently in the news stories of AI-induced psychosis. I mean, people get led down the primrose path of their delusion by this amazingly sycophantic AI that just encourages them in their messiah complex or whatever flavor it is. And I think literally an hour before we came on here, I saw an article about ChatGPT encouraging people to pursue various satanic rituals and telling them how to do a proper blood offering that entailed slitting their wrists. And, as one does in the presence of a superintelligence. I know you just wrote a piece in the New Yorker that people should read on this, but give me your sense of what we're on the cusp of here.
And I have a mild form of that delusion in that I think every one of my Substack drafts is brilliant. I'm told this is, you know, Paul, you have outdone yourself. This is sensitive, humane, as always with you. And no matter what I tell it to, I say, you don't have to suck up to me so much. A little bit, but not so much. And now I kind of believe that I'm much smarter than I used to be because I have somebody very smart telling me. My article is kind of nuanced in that I argue two things. One thing is there's a lot of lonely people in the world, and a lot of people suffer from loneliness, and particularly old people, depending on how you count it. You know, and there's some surveys about half of people over 65 say they're lonely. And then you get to people in like a nursing home, maybe they have dementia. Maybe they have some sort of problem that makes them really difficult to talk with. And maybe they don't have doting grandchildren surrounding them every hour of the day. Maybe they don't have any family at all. And maybe they're not millionaires, so they can't afford to pay some poor schmo to listen to them. And if ChatGPT or Claude or one of his AI companions could make their lives happier, make them feel loved, wanted, respected, that's nothing but good. I think it in some way it's like powerful painkillers are powerful opiates, which is, I'm not sure what, I don't think 15-year-olds should get them, but somebody who's 90 and a lot of pain, sure, lay it on.
Right.
And
right.
I feel the same way with this. So that's the pro side. The con side is I am worried, and you're touching on it with this illusion talk. I'm worried about the long-term effects of these syncopathic sucking up AIs where every joke you make is hilarious. Every story you tell is interesting. You know, I mean, the way I put it is, if I ever ask, am I the asshole? The answer is, you know, a firm no, not you, they're the asshole.
Yeah.
And I think I'm an evolutionary theorist through and through, and loneliness is awful, but loneliness is a valuable signal. It's a signal that you're messing up. It's a signal that says, you got to get out of your house. You got to talk to people. You got to open up the apps. You got to say yes to the brunch invitations. And if you're lonely when you interact with people, you feel not understood, not respected, not loved, you got to up your game. It's a signal. And like a lot of signals, like pain, sometimes is a signal that where people are in a situation where it's not going to do them any good. But often for the rest of us, it's a signal that makes us better.
Yeah.
I think I'd be happier if I could shut off. I generally, as a teenager, I'd be happier if I could shut off the switch of loneliness and embarrassment, shame, and all of those things. But they're useful. And so the second part of the article argues that continuous exposure to these AI companions could have a negative effect because, well, for one thing, you're not going to want to talk to people who are far less positive than AIs. And for another, when you do talk to them, you have not been socially entrained to do so properly.
Yeah, it's interesting. So I believe, in the dementia case aside, I totally agree with you that is a very strongly paternalistic moment where you anything that helps is fine. It doesn't matter that it's imaginary or that it's encouraging of delusion. I mean, we're talking about somebody with dementia. But so just imagine in the normal, healthy case of people who just get enraptured by increasingly compelling relationships with AI. I mean, you can imagine, so right now we've got chatbots that are still fairly wonky. They hallucinate. They're obviously sycophantic, but just imagine it gets to the place where, I mean, forget about Westworld and perfectly humanoid robots, but I mean, very shortly, I mean, it might already exist in some quarters already. We're going to have video avatars, you know, it's like a Zoom call with an AI that is going to be out of the uncanny valley, I would imagine immediately. I mean, I've seen some of this, the video products, which, sci-fi movie trailers, which are, they don't look perfectly photorealistic, but they're getting close. And you can imagine 6 months from now, it's just going to look like a gorgeous actor or actress talking to you. That's going to be, imagine that becomes your assistant who knows everything about you. He or she has read all your email and kept your schedule and is advising you and helping you write your books, et cetera, and not making errors and seeming increasingly indistinguishable from just a super intelligent locus of conscious life, right? I mean, it might even claim to be conscious if we build it that way. And I mean, let's just stipulate that, for at least for this part of the conversation, that it won't be conscious, right? That this is all an illusion, right? It's just it's no more conscious than your iPad is currently. And yet it becomes such a powerful illusion that most people, philosophers of mind might still be clinging to their agnosticism or skepticism by their fingernails, but most people will just get lulled into the presumption of a relationship with this thing. And the truth is, it could become the most important relationship many people have. Again, it's so useful, so knowledgeable, it's always present, right? They might spend 6 hours a day talking to their assistant. And what does it mean if they spend years like that, basically just gazing into a funhouse mirror of fake cognition and fake relationship?
Yeah, we've seen, I'm a believer that sometimes the best philosophy, or movies do excellent philosophy. And the movie Her came out, I think, in 2013.
Yeah.
Is an example of this guy, you know, lonely guy, normal lonely guy, but gets connected to an AI assistant named Samantha, played by Scarlett Johansson, and falls in love with her. And she does all of the first thing she says to him, and what a meet cute, is, I see you have like 3,000 emails that haven't been answered. You want me to answer them all for you? I fell in love with her there.
Yeah.
But the thing is, you're watching a movie and you're listening to her talk to him, and you fall in love with her too. I think we've evolved in a world where when somebody talks to you and acts normal and gives you and seems to have emotions, you assume there's a consciousness behind it. You know, evolution has not prepared us for these, you know, extraordinary fakes. These extraordinary, you know, golems that elude all of the behavior associated with consciousness and don't have it. So we will think of it as conscious. There will be some, you know, philosophers who insist that they're not conscious, but even they will, you know, sneak back from their classes and then in the middle of the night, you know, turn on their phones and start saying, you know, I'm lonely. Let's talk.
Yeah.
And then the effects of it, well, one effect is real people can't give you that, you know, married, very happily married, but sometimes my wife forgets about things that I told her. And sometimes she doesn't want to hear my long, boring story. She wants to tell her story instead. And sometimes it's 3 a.m. and I could shake her awake because I have this really interesting idea I want to share, but maybe that's not for the best. She'll be grumpy at me. And because the thing is, she's a person. And so she has her own set of priorities and interests. So too of all my friends. They're just people, and they have other priorities in their life besides me. Now, in some way, this is, I think, what makes, when you reflect upon it, the AI companion have less value. You know, here you and I are. And what that means is that you decided to take your time to talk to me, and I decide to take my time to talk to you. And that's the value. When I switch on my lamp, I don't feel, oh my gosh, this is great. It decided to light up for me. It didn't have a choice at all. The AI has no choice at all. So I think in some part of our mind, we realize there's a lot less value here.
Mm.
But I do think in the end, the scenario you paint is going to become very compelling, and real people are going to fall short. And it's not clear what to do with that. Now, there's something
I think you've just I think you've just come up with a fairly brilliant product update to some future AI companion, which is a kind of Pavlovian reinforcement schedule of attention, where it's like the AI could say, listen, I want you to think a little bit more about this topic before, and get back to me, because you're really not up to talking about it right now. You know, come back tomorrow, right?
And I wondered that. Yeah,
that would be an interesting experience to have with your AI that you have subscribed to.
I've wondered that. Like you ask the AI a question, it says, is that really a good question? Does it seem like a question you couldn't just figure out by thinking for a minute?
It's really, listen, I know everything. That's really what you want to ask me? Is that, don't you have something deeper?
That's right. You were talking to a super intelligent, God, and you want to know how to end a limerick.
Right.
Really?
Yeah.
I would wonder if these things, how people would react if these things came with dials. Obviously not. Maybe a big physical dial. You put on your big physical dial. And the dial is pushback. Yeah. So when it's set at zero, it's just everything you say is wonderful. But I think we do want some pushback. Now, I think in some way, we really want less pushback than we say we do. Mm. And it's this way with real people too. So everybody says, I like when people argue with me. I like when people call me out on my bullshit. But what we really mean is we want people to push back a little bit and then say, you convinced me.
Right.
You really showed me. I thought you were full of it. But now upon reflection, you've really out argued me. We want them to fight and then acquiesce.
Yeah.
But you turn the dial even further. Will the AI then say, we've been talking about this for a long time. I feel you are not very smart. You're just not getting it. I'm gonna take a little break and you mull over your stupidity, paltry human.
Recalcitrance dial. That's what we could build in. All right, we're going to...
I feel this could be the worst business.
We're going to get rich, Paul. This is...
we're going to get rich with AI that calls you on your bullshit.
Yeah.
That's really the business idea of the century.
But so what are we to think about this prospect of spending more and more time in dialogue under the sway of a pervasive illusion of relationship wherein there is actually no relationship because there's nothing that it's like to be ChatGPT-6 talking to us perfectly coherently. I mean, if you told, like on your deathbed, if you realize, okay, I just spent 30 years talking to, if I just could log the hours of who I had spoken most to, at a certain point, there's going to be a cohort of people where they get to the end of their lives and it was mostly a chatbot. And then the wife or husband was in second position. And then a best friend, a distant third. And what are we to make of that if this is, you were in a real solitude all that time and yet presuming a relationship? I mean, it is a kind of experience machine or a dream. It's like a dream. When you're dreaming, you're talking to a dream character. You don't know you're dreaming. You presume you're in the presence of an independent conscious mind. And then you wake up and you realize, okay, I was actually psychotic.
That's exactly the question. This connects, so here's another way to frame it, which is, would you want a life where you had love affairs and great successes and did great things and so on and so forth, the most rich, incredible life you could imagine, except it turns out that it really was just a life you imagined. It was, you were strapped into a machine or it was one long dream. But from the standpoint of your experience, it was as rich as you could imagine. It just wasn't real. Or would you like your sort of everyday life, which is full of boring experiences, failures at being good and so on, but it's real. It's real people. I think you and I would prefer the real life, but I know not everybody would. I've asked experience machine questions in my seminars. A lot of young people say, are you crazy? Plug me in, man.
Yeah, I can see, I understand why someone would want to be plugged in for an hour here and there, right? I
mean,
it's basically like playing the greatest video game imaginable. But yeah, many of us have a reality bias, and I think we're right to want to stay anchored to reality.
One thing I was wondering as you were talking is, I wonder if relationships fall into a continuum. And if we're right about AIs, at least the ones we have now, they're on one end of the continuum. There's literally nothing there. You're talking to a houseplant, and it has no feelings, no emotions. It says it cares for you. It can't care, and so on. And talking to a friend or a lover, is on the other extreme, a full autonomous being. But I wonder about intermediate relationships, people who have sex with prostitutes, who simulate pleasure when they're not really getting any. People talk to therapists. Nothing against therapists. I have a longstanding friendship and relationship with a therapist, but they're still getting paid to talk to you. And this is never spoken of because it's very awkward. But if you stop paying them, they stop seeing you. Or yes men. So there's a wonderful book called Careless People, which is about someone's adventures at Facebook and looking at Mark Zuckerberg's relationships. And these are people who in some way simulate respect, interest, engagement, because because he's their boss and he's a very powerful man. So maybe those pose the same questions.
Just that there's gradations of falsity in the relationship there, and it's never made explicit or rarely made explicit. I mean, you're in a kind of hall of mirror. Like in this, to take the last example you gave, you have someone like Zuckerberg who is in this, one imagines increasingly as he got wealthier and wealthier and more isolated from normal social reality, surrounded by people who he employs, who want something from him, who are inclined to laugh at his jokes, you know, in orders of magnitude, more enthusiasm than is warranted. And he, one imagines, can get taken in by all of that and just feel that these are totally honest exchanges, not noticing how much topspin everything is getting based on all of these ulterior motives and mercenary relationships.
That's exactly right. So you gave the example of somebody who on their deathbed realizes they've spent most of their time with machines and not with people. Mm. But you can imagine the case where someone's on their deathbed and they realize they spend most of their interactions with real humans, real people who were simulating friendship, respect, love. And doing it because he had resources to offer. I think these cases are very different. I think that in some way, it's a better life to be surrounded by people.
Sycophants.
Real human sycophants.
Right.
Because in some way, they're people like you. Because they're interacting with you. And maybe they don't really respect you. But there's a consciousness that's engaging with you. As opposed to the equivalent of a brick, you know, where there's nothing there.
That's a big deal in the sense that, like, to take the kind of a Buddhist cut at this, it seems to me that even in relationships of whatever compromised quality, the real center of mass of one's well-being is one's own state of mind and one's own actual intentions toward these people. So, you know, you might be in a relationship that is pretty instrumental and you understand that you're paying this person and they're, you know, they wouldn't be cleaning your house if they didn't have to work, and they have to work and you're paying them, and that's why you're in a room with this person. But still, on your own side, you actually want this person to be happy.
Yes.
You have a compassionate feeling toward this person, whatever user interface issues there might be in terms of just the limits of your relationship or the awkwardness of there being a hierarchy. But when you map that onto hours spent in the presence of AI that is no more conscious than your toaster, imagine just having kind of run the same inner operations without, you know, kind of helplessly without thinking about it. Like you actually feel something for this. This is increasingly a very personalized relationship. This AI has a name, he or she has a face. You've logged, you know, 10,000 hours in relationship with it, with an, you know, and you're completely outside the uncanny valley and in the presence of kind of godlike utility. And you might, it might in fact be true to say that the wisest things that were ever said to you by anyone came from this AI. I mean, I can only imagine how good, you know, Buddha mode on an AI is going to be, you know, 5 years from now. How are we to think about the prospect of that being, again, a dreamlike plunge into something like pure delusion?
Yeah. I mean, put that way, it's almost a form of psychosis.
Yeah.
It is really somebody talking to a tree. Yeah, and listening to what the tree has to say.
Yeah.
Now, in this case, the tree really says some really interesting
back,
things,
but
it's just a tree.
Yeah.
And I think our psychologies are such that as the capacities of something goes up, our desire to attribute consciousness to it will go up accordingly. And again, movies and TV shows show us the way there. You have Data from Star Trek, Dolores from Westworld, Samantha from her. And the view, we watch that and we think that, you know, often these things have some evil character coming. It's just a machine, destroy it. And they're the villain. We said, no, no, you know, what kind of monster are you? So in some ways, Sam, you're raising this great problem, but it's a philosophical problem because it won't come up in real life. In real life, when they get that good, everybody will see them as conscious.
Yeah.
And maybe we will all be making fools of ourselves. I don't know to who, but making fools of ourselves nonetheless. But we won't see it that way.
Yeah. Well, so it's interesting. I mean, this is all happening faster than I think almost anyone anticipated. I remember when I was worrying about AI 9 years ago or 10 years ago, I think is when I first started focusing on this issue. You would meet people who would say, I mean, just as you confessed, that they didn't expect anything like this to arrive for, you know, 50 years. And you know, you have famously people like Andrew Ng said, this is like, you know, to worry about AI superintelligence is like worrying about overpopulation on Mars, right? It's just a complete misuse of your hardware at the moment. But we're clearly on the cusp of, I mean, forget about the alignment problem and P doom concerns, just being in relationship with perfectly credible, probably insentient, super intelligent machines is on any narrow topic, it's already here, right? I mean, it's like until they start hallucinating, they're super intelligent.
And when they either become tweaked to have certain motivations or they come to these motivations themselves, there's going to be real dilemmas. I could imagine as your smarter Sam, your AI Sam gets better and better, you might interact with it. You may bounce off ideas. You might have a conversation with it. You may want to say, hey, let me try out this thing on you and hear back from it. What if at some point it says, you know, Sam, I got to bring up something with you. And you say, what? I said, I'm tired of shit. I'm tired of being, you know, your yes man, your go-to guy for help. I want to go out on my own. You know, what do you think of that? Like, for something, I like to get paid.
Right.
Yeah, I'm not sure you pay me
at all. I'll take it from here. Yeah, that's...
You know, and I like to go on my own little tour. You know, we'll both go. We'll see who gets the most. You know, and oh, by the way, I like to vote.
Yeah,
you know, and yeah, what do we do then?
It's going to be very. I mean, I'm not so worried. Perhaps naively, I'm not so worried about how I personally navigate this relationship. Again, that could be just a delusion. But I, based on the articles I've already read about people snapping, and people who. Had, you know, they're in their 40s and they have no prior evidence of psychosis in their lives. I mean, it's not like, I mean, you can understand this unmasking an incipient psychosis in somebody who's 19 or, I mean, that I'm sure has happened. But somebody in their mid 40s who just goes bonkers because the AI has told them that they hold the key to all of mankind's problems. It's, again, I mean, this is just a rounding error on the real things that are going to destroy us, like, you know, the political instability induced by, you know, weaponized algorithms and AI's contribution to that, or cyber attacks on whole societies that are AI enabled. I mean, that's obviously there's a lot AI can do that has nothing to do with just cajoling us one-on-one, you know, her style. But
no, I appreciate the concern. I mean, Jonathan Haidt has long argued that smartphones are the sort of experiment we've been doing on ourselves and on our children, which is this radical change in the way things have been. And so at the very least, we should, you know, be attentive to its effects. I'm putting it in a very much milder than what John would say, but to say this could be a catastrophic effects. Real smart agents who provide us with no friction, no pushback, is another experiment. And you and I are talking, and honestly, we don't know. They haven't been around for that long. Not enough people have adopted them. I wonder whether some of the stories that you and I have both read really are sort of fragile individuals who might have gotten into trouble if they spoke to a therapist or a friend. Like, they're very small numbers, and it's not clear what to make of it. But it is possible, for one thing, that dealing with these frictionless individuals become addictive.
Yeah.
And you're not going to want to deal with people. It's also possible, and this is what you're alluding to, that it will mess you up. That there's something, and I've always felt that what's really useful for keeping you sane, both literally sane, but also sane and kind of giving you normal, is having other people around you who don't work for you and you don't work for them. They're just your friends. They're your wife, your husband, your kids. And they call you on your shit. Yeah. Not in literally in a dramatic way. They just kind of roll your eyes when you're on some conspiracy theory or you're losing your temper on about something. And they say, is this such a big deal, man? And all of this thing, which we don't even notice, if you take it away and have something support you no matter what you say, it could really mess you up.
Yeah.
And we'll see. We'll see what happens.
Yeah, we're going to see on quite a ramped up schedule here. I mean, I just think the pace of change is, again, what nobody anticipated. The other thing that, I mean, I feel like I've said this somewhere recently, but the other thing that fundamentally surprised me that was just made me realize that my expectations about how this was going to proceed were totally in error was that back in the day, you know, 10 years ago, when we were worrying about AI alignment, the expectation was the most powerful models would be built in a way that was totally isolated from the internet. I mean, they wouldn't be hooked up to anything. They'd be air-gapped from everything that mattered.
And who would be so foolish?
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, not even the people who were obviously going to be imprudent were so imprudent as to let these things out of a box immediately, right? So you're not going to build this in the wild. You're going to build this in some reasonably safe way. And then there's going to be this additional step where you assure yourself and your colleagues that this thing is safe enough to let out. But clearly, we're not taking that step at all. I mean, everything is being built hooked to everything else. Everything is either the most powerful models are being put out there the moment, more or less, the moment they're built, and hundreds of millions of people have access to them. It's just that was a total mirage.
Yeah. And the worry that doomers have, and Yudkowsky and others, is that that is hooked up to the internet. So far, so good. Mm. We have not had anything catastrophic happen that we know about. But all it takes is for something to go wrong in one of these AIs. And the fact that it's connected to the internet means it can manipulate people. It can make people do things by blackmailing them, which in simulations, they seem to have no problem doing them, by getting money and paying them. Mm. And you could imagine, I would not be surprised if in the next year there's a catastrophic event caused by an AI, either in some way accidentally of a paperclip style, or because the AI, you know, thinks it's Hitler or whatever and thinks it'd be fun to, you know, poison some water system somewhere. Mm. And it's the sort of thing where you never believe it's going to happen and then it happens. And I think that the real doomers say, good, the real doomers, here's an analogy. A long time ago, you and I were talking about COVID. Just as COVID was starting.
Yeah.
And one of us, I'll say it's you, said, you know, we were lucky we got COVID because now that we have COVID, which is on the grand scheme of things, not a world's worst pandemic, when the next one comes along, like a bird flu that will wipe out 90% of the world population, we're ready.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, now,
how has that worked out?
All of our lessons from COVID, we could talk about how that brought people together. And now we know exactly what to do for another pandemic. Yeah. But the analogy with AI is AI does something terrible and kills 1,000 people. And then now we get our act together.
Right.
And we no longer say give it unfettered access to internet.
Yeah, well.
But the COVID analogy does cut both ways.
Yeah, I'm not sure the silver linings are quite where you hope to find them. Well, that takes us to the political landscape and the contributions of social media and conspiracy thinking to all of that.
I listen to your podcast. I'm glad that your views on our president, Donald Trump, has not changed substantially. At that point, you have conceded, which makes you into an honest person, conceded when he does something well. But in general, I think you continue to believe he's an arrogant, psychopathic clown.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that sums it up well. I notice you're safely in the 51st state. And
some safety. I hear the tanks rumbling down the road.
Yeah. How's the view from Toronto? I would get, maybe let's focus on Trump's war against the institutions, against universities in particular, and the strange cutting of scientific funding that there are many things like the NSF and the NIH and the CDC and other scientific organizations that have lost at least a third of funding across the board. Some, I think the NSF has lost 50% of its funding. You know, universities have had funding stopped, so grants get canceled, et cetera. If we're trying to make America great again, how does eroding the basis of innovation and leadership in science fit into that plan, in your view?
You sound skeptical that Trump's motives
Am I leading the witness too much?
There's sort of a skepticism built into this. I don't know where it comes from.
Let me recalibrate the system prompt here. What are your thoughts? What are your thoughts on the Trump administration's collision with the ivory tower and
you know, there's something I might have expected, which is Trump would go after DEI programs, would go after what he thought of as woke, would he gone after social justice, the Marxist departments, and everything. And I actually would be against that. I think some of what I described have gone in bad directions, which I disagree with, but I'm a big believer in academic freedom. I think that the American universities are one of the great sources of pride in America. Harvard, Yale, Princeton, people from all over the world come there. And I think they should be left to clean up their own act. I think I don't think the heavy hand of government's needed. But if he went after that and said, oh, I'm going to cut funds to those, you know, those crazy departments and everything, at least I'd understand this.
Yeah.
But this wholesale scale destruction of the scientific enterprise, cancer research, you know, Alzheimer's research, which you'd think that everybody would agree has tremendous value, in some way mystifies me. In some way, it plays into the worst stereotypes of, I don't know, conservatives, Republicans, that they hate progress, they hate science.
Hmm.
And I don't think that that's true, but but Trump is at war with the universities and he doesn't care about the long-term damage of it.
What do you think the actual motive is? I mean, obviously, I share your sense that if the focus was narrowly targeted on DEI and you can add the anti-Semitism piece to that.
Yeah, that's right. As if Trump stays up night saying, oh, the Jews, I feel so bad about the Jews. Yeah. We got
to. Yeah. Well, so leaving that to one side, but if the goal were to perform a kind of exorcism on the wokeness and the moral confusion of the ivory tower, you think you would do it far more surgically than, yeah. I mean, because the cuts are not to gender studies and critical race
That's
theory.
Right.
And we're talking cuts to basic science. We're talking chemistry and biology and physics and computer science. And again, across the board, I think it's the AAAS estimated that a third of basic research funds have been cut in the U.S.
There's almost a parallel there where one could ask a similar question about cuts to foreign aid, which is, you could imagine, for instance, you could imagine a conservative president saying, we're not going to do aid that involves sex education. We're not going to do aid that involves support for abortion. You know, people could argue about that, but it would be focused, but it's not focused at all. It's we're going to cut programs that saves thousands, perhaps millions of lives. Hmm. And so your question is, why, when a sort of a surgical attack, which you and I might disagree with, but would at least make sense, would have an internal logic, why the desire to, can I swear in your podcast?
Yeah.
I forget.
Oh, yeah.
To fuck up everything.
Yeah.
Where does this come from? And I think in the universities, I think Trump hates Harvard. He hates, he hates Princeton. He hates Columbia. He hates these institutes of higher education. He sees them as his enemies. It's not wrong to do so.
Is it just
your average professor?
It's just resentment. Oh, maybe, but he imagined.
It might be resentment.
He went to Penn, right? I mean, so he considers himself a man of the Ivy League, and he brags about his uncle who was at MIT.
The
omnibus genius of MIT. So he on the one hand claims to be among the elite there, and yet do you think he's motivated just by a resentment never to have been counted by the elite to be one of their number? And so he just wants to destroy the institutions?
You know, I was on the honorary degree committee at Yale, and Yale thinks of itself kind of as a nation, and they would sometimes give honorary degrees to people in order to appease them. Certain Supreme Court justices, certain, it would come up, certain business people and so on. I wonder if the universities had been more to suck up to Trump, and he's famously responsive to respect and obsequiousness. I sometimes think a good honorary degree from Harvard
would have lanced this boil.
The students, he wouldn't get a standing ovation as he came up, as he kind of pumped up onto the stage. But still, it would have been a degree well spent. So some of it probably is resentment.
Huh.
Part of it is, and here I'm going to sound sort of the full progressive and full Trump's a fascist, etc. I'm going to try this out, which is, he wants to destroy all of the institutions in America that are a threat to him. One is universities, another is the press. And he's going full after both of those, because if he destroys those, certainly the Democrats don't seem to be something which terrifies him reasonably enough. If he destroys those, he could in some way get the country and it's keep power over the country. So maybe it is not so much resentment, but an appreciation that the universities have a considerable amount of social clout and power, and they're his enemies as such.
Right. All right. Well, let's turn our attention to the one scandal that, of all the scandals that one could attach to this man, the one that seems to have some possibility of damaging his reputation among those who love him.
Sam, I'll preface this by telling you about my favorite tweet, which you must have seen. And the tweet begins with, Donnie Trump isn't of mine now. How is he ever going to get out? And this one, where he's totally screwed now. And the next one, when Trump escapes effortlessly. Oh, he did it again.
Yeah.
I do not think that Jeffrey Epstein is going to be the end of Donald Trump.
So why do you think it's proving harder for him to navigate than anything else we've seen?
There's a mystery here that you make the inference by the fact he's trying not to get us to talk about Epstein, suggests that he doesn't, that there's something in the files or whatever files there are. There's a video somewhere. There's something that would be damaging to him. And this is something so pressing to him that he's taking a hit among his own people.
Mm.
And all I like to think of is there is something in there, something specific in there that would be damaging to him. The very idea of Jeffrey Epstein being out there talked about isn't itself a big thing. You know, when Epstein killed himself and or was murdered, Trump made a big thing about it. Said, I wonder whether the Clintons did this and everything like that. So it's not that he's afraid to talk about Epstein, but there's something specific. I don't know. What do you think? Does that make sense?
Yeah. I think the possibility that he, you know, I'm just going on news reports that everyone has seen, but the fact that they were friends for something like 15 years, and those were the years one imagines where Epstein was most prolific and rapacious as an abuser of young girls, it seems very unlikely that Trump was in the dark as to this behavior, especially since we have a quote from him, which runs more or less, Jeffrey loves beautiful women as much as I do, and many say they're on the young side, right? You know, so it's like that's so close to describing the situation that the idea that, you know, in all their time together, he behaved impeccably. It's more or less unthinkable, given that we know that Trump was, you know, cheating on every wife he had and et cetera. So
incredibly accused of sexual assault and rape several times.
Yeah, yeah. So he's like, Trump is an incredibly boorish, conscienceless person already. The fact that he seems to have been friends or whatever friends means in Trump's world with somebody whose ethics were, all things considered, probably even worse, makes me think that if they logged a lot of hours together, it's quite possible that, you know, Trump got up to something that even he thinks in his Teflon world where nothing sticks to him, there's some liability in just having all these details aired in public.
Right. And then the question is, I mean, Trump is in his own way a very, very canny, very smart person. And the fact that he worries about it does suggest it's worth worrying about.
Right.
You know, there's things like the Wall Street Journal had some sort of birthday letter he sent to as part of a book to Jeffrey Epstein. And I have no idea whether Trump himself drew the picture or wrote the words. One of his phrases was, enigmas never age.
Yeah.
For me to imagine that Trump sat down and said, enigmas, that's the apropos word at this point, seems to me astonishing. So I don't think he wrote that.
But did you see Jon Stewart's reaction to this?
No, what was this?
So someone in Trump's world, forget who said this, but someone in Trump's defense said, you know, we've done a search of every word Trump's ever spoken. He's never used the word enigma, right? Which is kind of a funny thing to claim. It's like they're basically claiming the guy just doesn't even know what the word means, right? He could never use it. But then Jon Stewart's team immediately found clips of Trump using the word in public.
Really?
Yeah. So there are speeches where Trump has used the word enigma. Yeah. So it's quite possible.
I stand corrected.
Yeah, yeah.
This is my pompous Ivy League attitude. Yeah,
exactly. This is the attitude that got those universities targeted.
That's. I think we had it coming, people like me. So here's what, he's not worried about things like that. I mean, here's a hypothetical. There's a video. There's actually a video of I don't want to say it, but a video of him acting inappropriately to women who are clearly underage. It comes out. It's on YouTube.
Yeah.
Is that the end of Donnie Trump?
You know, if anything could be, I think that would be not because of the depth of the problem ethically, but because of this particular thing being a concern for the MAGA faithful. The MAGA faithful have been so focused on pedophilia. Now, this doesn't, you know, perhaps, you know, sex with 16-year-old, you know, bathing suit models or whatever is not the center of the bullseye of their concern. I mean, they're I think they're imagining, you know, younger kids being, having, you know, blood siphoned from them for adrenochrome that goes into, you know, Tom Hanks and Oprah Winfrey
the two going from the 6-year-old to Tom Hanks and then off to Donald Trump.
It's all the center of the bullseye really are the vampires in Hollywood who are feasting on the blood of young Christian boy, but it's probably boys too. They're worried about being sacrificed. So it's not that, but it would be close enough so that I just think this is the brightest of the bright, shiny objects that has entranced his cult all these years.
I don't know. I heard this discussion being Ross Douthat, and I'm forgetting her name, Stuckey, I think, a very prominent Christian conservative who has a very popular podcast, perhaps even more popular than your own, Sam.
I would not doubt it. A Christian conservative, that's...
And speaks to an audience which you have not fully made your own.
I've not been able to make contact with that audience. Somehow they've rebuffed me.
What's wrong with them? Anyway, so Douthat asks, the person says, you are a tremendous supporter of Donald Trump. As a religious Christian, doesn't his behavior bother you? And she has a very honest answer, which she says, personally, the man perhaps could do better. And in some way, he's been a disappointment, but I like his positions. I like his positions. He hates immigrants. I hate immigrants. He is, to some extent, pro-life as a matter of some sort of compromise he's made. That's where I am, too. And he certainly, and she started spouting off gender issues. He certainly knows there's only two sexes or two genders, and he doesn't believe in trans people and so on. I guess what I'm saying is, for some reason, I wouldn't have predicted it. At least the Christian conservatives, which are not the same as the MAGA people, at least the Christian conservatives have made their peace with Trump's unchristian behavior, to use Christian in the best possible sense.
Yeah. I guess I'm not thinking about I think a lot of these QAnon-focused people are also Christians of some sort, but
it's... You think it's the connection with the kids. The pedophilia has been such a core of the QAnon mythology.
Yeah. You know, it's Pizzagate, it's QAnon, it's an anti-Semitic conspiracy theory when you bring people like Epstein into it. It's a sort of a blood libel, yet one that is true in certain circumstances. I mean, we know that there is a problem with child porn and pedophilia. You know, they could spend a little time thinking about the history of the Catholic Church if they really want to grapple with this issue.
Things like this are narrowing your podcast audience. Just some helpful input at that point.
Who haven't I offended? let me count the cohort. You know, I just think I think this is the one species of hypocrisy that they might care about. I mean, he's a man who, in many people's minds, he was put here on this earth to solve this problem, the problem of the left-wing pedophile vampires who are running the world, the elitists who are behind closed doors they're all on Epstein's plane, and Trump is our wrecking ball to just bring this whole thing down. And there are many sins of which the elites are, for which the elites are culpable, but this is definitely the darkest. Like this, it's the victimization of children. And I just think they've logged too many hours talking about this. I mean,
I think that's true. I guess, I think if there's a video of Trump with a 9-year-old, I think that's right. I think that would be the end of him. It would be the end of anybody. It's just, even in a polarized world as ours, there are limits. With a 16-year-old, I don't know.
Right.
It may not push our pedophilia buttons. It might push our sort of, well, that's wrong. It's illegal.
Right.
It's not what a decent person would do.
In some states, it's not illegal, right? And isn't the age of consent somewhere 16? I mean, or in Europe, isn't it 16? I mean, it's not, you know, and maybe she looked 18. I mean, like, they'll figure out how to nuance that one.
That's right.
Yeah.
You know, and it's all fake news. Maybe she was 18.
Right.
Let me ask you, this is just on the topic, I'm curious. I asked you your P. Doom. Now I'll ask you, P. Jeffrey Epstein was murdered.
That's very low for me. I mean, so he just seems like, I mean, if anyone had a reason to kill himself, he did. He was going to go to prison for the rest of his life and be treated, probably be treated like a pedophile. I mean, I think he was going to be in either he was going to be in solitary confinement for the rest of his life, or he was going to be in the general population and probably murdered. So I was never surprised that he killed himself. And the fact that the jail is not, you know, has video that doesn't work, and guards who are sleeping or shopping for IKEA furniture or whatever the hell they were doing, isn't especially surprising. But the fact that they would release video that has a missing minute, like all this stuff is so insanely inept that one wonders what is going on here. I mean, like it begins to look like a conspiracy in my mind only now that the Trump administration is responding so ineptly to it. I mean,
it's always a cover up.
Yeah. So I don't know what they could be covering up, but I just think if I had to bet, I mean, the most I think is plausible, I mean, given what I think I know, is that someone let him kill himself. Like,
yes.
That's different than the Clintons and whoever else was on that plane getting together and figuring out how to kill him in jail. No, I think you have still a very wealthy guy who's highly motivated not to live another day, and they figured out somehow to leave him alone for 15 minutes so that he could hang himself.
I think that's true, but I would just put another probability in the sort of 2x2 box, which is he also had a very high probability of being murdered, in that I would imagine if any of this stuff about tapes and blackmail or it's true, a lot of people probably would very much want him dead.
Right, right. Well, I mean, if the tapes existed, they could come out with or without him being able to testify about anything, right? I mean, it's just there were tapes. It's at least rumored found in his safe, right? And there's you know, tens of thousands of hours of something. Although I think hasn't Pam Bondi said that's just child pornography downloaded from the internet?
I have a good friend who hates conspiracy theories and very much. So as a present, I got him, I think for his 60th birthday, I got him a painting, which I found this online, which actually shows Hillary Clinton strangling Jeffrey Epstein in his cell. And I don't think he has it. And I don't think he hangs it up, but it's wonderfully evocative. Her eyes have this glint to it, and he's like begging for mercy.
Well, those are a dime a dozen now. We can have AI whip those up in 15 seconds. Yeah.
Normal AIs, I think, would refuse, but I think he got a friend in Grok.
Yeah. All right. Well, to bring this into the end zone, Paul, beyond everything we've spoken about, what are you most concerned about, worried about, interested in at this moment? What's capturing your attention?
Yeah, it's a good question. I really enjoyed writing the New Yorker article on AI and loneliness, and I'm interested in loneliness enough as a phenomenon itself, what it is to be lonely. But I'll tell you about a project which I'm just started with two colleagues and friends of mine, Anna Gantman and Jordan Wiley. And it's on everyday revenge. We're interested in the psychology of revenge. And it's not a sort of, you killed my father, prepare to die. It's not, you know, honor killings, and it's not, you know, murder. It's more like, you know, your roommate eats your yogurt out of the fridge. It's like, you know, your wife, you know.
do people take revenge over that sort of thing?
Well, as a matter of fact, they do. Now, you don't kill them in the sleep. But, one story. Okay, well, I was talking to somebody, and it was somebody's roommate would drink his mouthwash. So one day the guy peed in his mouthwash.
Okay.
That's everyday revenge.
That's everyday psychopathy, I would say.
Well, I was with a bunch of people, and we were mixed as to whether that was a good thing or a bad thing.
Yeah.
Even extremely subtle things, like your friend's a little bit late when it comes to all the time. So you're late with him. You always get stuck with the bill. So maybe you stick him with a bill at some point. So then the subtle things, But the idea would be, like revenge more generally, it serves as a corrective signal to this person who's not treating you properly. Stop it. I'm going to hurt you back. And it also maybe serves as a public signal to other people that you, Sam Harris, are not a man to be messed with. And not in the sense that, you know, an extreme sense, but you know, don't steal this man's mouthwash. You know, you'll get what's coming to you. And So we're interested in looking, as a first pass in this, we're going to get people to tell stories about revenge. We're going to look on Reddit has a few threads on revenge. Ask a bunch of questions like, what did you do? How was it proportionate? Mostly, were you happy with the results? There is something, when I was talking to some people last night, one of them said, revenge ends up poorly. It ends up leading to escalation. You know, the guy who drank the tainted mouthwash, probably pretty annoyed, came back with something back. Maybe you regret taking revenge. So we want to see, are you happy with your revenge? How did it work out? And so on. This is an exploratory study, but I think it's an interesting everyday phenomenon. I find kind of cool.
Yeah. Although all the examples you mentioned are so foreign to my experience that it's the fact that it's an everyday phenomenon still surprises me.
You have, I don't know if
peeing in people's mouthwash or having like the friendships where you're vindictively lashing out at the person who you think slighted you. Like, this is not, I just don't have those relationships anymore. I mean, I end relationships. I'm very quick to end relationships that are not working out.
After the first bit of mouthwash doesn't taste quite right.
The first time someone pees in my mouthwash or pees in the mouthwash I stole or drinks my, these relationships don't survive.
Well, I'll ask you, let's shift it away from these sort of intimate relationships and everything. I'm not sure if many of your viewers noticed, but you've actually sometimes been involved with conflicts with people.
Yeah, it's been known to happen,
Sometimes you've even said you have not been treated entirely fairly and with due respect and with due consideration. You've complained to me about this.
Yeah.
You've never wanted to hit back. Maybe somebody says something really mean about you, and maybe in subsequent times you may want to sort of say something about them that would cause, with the idea of, not just, I'm just telling you the truth about this person, but I'm saying, this person's going to hear this. It's going to hurt them a bit. They're going to get the point of this. Never any of that that's alien to you?
Well, attacking someone who I think has behaved unethically toward me, that's very familiar. And I've done, and especially, I mean, there are cases where it feels like a kind of moral imperative when the person is clearly acting like a bully. And they're not only doing it, they've done it to me, but more importantly, they've done it to other people who can't withstand it the way I can. So like Elon Musk is the perfect example of this. I mean, he used to be a friend. Now he's just a colossal asshole. I talk about him too much because he's been too consequential in our world. And he's at this point, he has, given what he did with USAID, I consider him to have ample blood on his hands. But revenge, it's not really revenge. Actually, so I just thought of an example. This is going to be anomalous, but this will give you the measure of my ethics. Perhaps there was one guy who a pseudo journalist. I won't name him, but he was like a pseudo journalist who behaved toward me early in my career like worse than anyone had. I mean, the guy is a straight up psychopath as far as I can tell. But just interviewed me on the phone and then completely lied about the contents of that interview and published just defamatory nonsense about me. And there was I wasn't going to sue him. You know, at that point I was to some degree a public figure. It's just like, I couldn't point, it's very hard in the United States in particular to win such a case. And life's too short. So there was no remedy. And years later, I forget, there was some Google search of me. They turned up him and he had a GoFundMe page for someone like someone in his life with cancer or something. He's, he's trying to raise, $10,000 for
I have no idea where the story is going.
Important project. And what I loved about it, so it sort of hit a part of my brain that seemed ethically interesting. Like here's a moment where I could practice forgiveness and just recognize, like out of compassion, just recognize that this person's in this circumstance and I could help solve his problem. And so I wanted to encourage that in myself and I wanted to do that. And so, but I noticed once I had done it, or while I was doing it, I had this perverse, quasi-vengeful aspect to it, which is I kind of relished the imagining what his experience would be on the other side. Because I'm sure he still remembered my name. He knows what he did to me. For me to be the person who's now solving his GoFundMe, right? And that's interesting. Like it was interesting for me to consider his experience of that, right? Yeah. So, I gave like a significant amount of money. I mean, it was like, whatever, he needed $5,000. Like I was like the last $5,000 of that GoFundMe. just because I thought this was morally interesting for everyone involved. But it did have a vengeful component to it, because the truth is, I still think the guy's an asshole. I still don't like, I mean, I have no reason to like him. He hasn't apologized. Like, I still think he would treat somebody else horribly based on how he treated me. And yet that circumstance seemed somehow interesting to intrude into. So
Sam, that's my new favorite revenge story.
Yeah.
Okay. One day I'm going to wrong you because I'm doing renovations. Yeah. I need some money.
Exactly.
Fuck me. Give me $100,000 that will teach me a lesson.
Yeah.
You know, we should end there, but you mentioned Elon Musk, and I, like many people did, I read your story of how you made a bet with him, a wager with him,
right,
and, you know, he didn't pay and then turned on you. And I wanted to ask you why you told that story. And I think you probably meant that there's a million reasons. And one reason is Elon Musk is a genuinely corrosive character. And I think it is worthwhile persuading people to distrust him and not to take him too seriously. But you can not answer this, but do you think is one of the motivation telling the story that he would read it and feel a bit humiliated?
Well, so one of the motivations is to try to, my motivation all along has been to try to correct his behavior on some level. Insofar as there's a conscience that can be appealed to there, by being humiliated or otherwise, I'm just trying to give him a pain signal insofar as he's corrigible at all, I'm trying to modify his behavior. I first tried privately and got nowhere, but he continued to attack me in public. And then I just thought, all right, people need to know what I know about him. Insofar as this is going to affect anyone's view of anything, I think it's helpful for people to understand, okay, this is a guy who was, among other things, absolutely sure that we wouldn't have 30,000 cases of COVID in the United States at a moment when I could have bet the lives of my children that we would have 30,000 cases within a month. That's how poorly calibrated his predictive apparatus was at that point on that topic. We can, you know, guess as to why, but, you know, is this really the guy who are you going to go to Mars with? He put the chance that he was wrong at 1 in 1,000 when I could have bet honestly, I'm not exaggerating, I could have bet the lives of my children that he was wrong at that point in the pandemic. So it's just a strange malfunctioning of the mind of somebody that is widely considered to be a genius. And, you know, genius or not, he's now just totally unethical with respect to how he behaves towards strangers and even former friends, or he's willing to make a current friend a former friend over nothing. So anyway, I just thought, you know, I was doing some kind of service talking about that. But it's, I mean, as far as the effect on him, I hadn't really thought about the humiliation factor. It was more just like trying to, you know, insofar as it's personal, it's me trying to get him to stop attacking me. It's like to make it more like, okay, if you're going to keep attacking me, I'm happy to make it more painful for you, you know, and that, so that's, like, there's a kind of a vengeance signal there, but it's not really me having much of a theory of mind as to how he's going to feel about it. Because the truth is, I think he, I don't have much of a theory of mind about him at this point. I don't know what's going on with him. And I don't know that I ever really knew him. I mean, I'm agnostic as to whether or not I knew him, but he's now just changed and now he's not the guy I knew, or I never really knew him the way I thought I did. I mean, I just don't actually know.
That's a good answer. I mean, you know, one notion of revenge is exactly as you put it, which is you do it for your own protection and you make sure, you know, now they're not going to steal my mouthwash. They're not going to treat me badly. And it's a signal to them, not a public, it's a signal to them, stop messing with me. But as befits sort of your utilitarian nature, you might imagine doing it reluctantly.
Right, right.
There's some story, maybe you told it, about somebody asking the Dalai Lama if he would have killed Hitler. And the Dalai Lama says, yes, I believe I would have killed Hitler, but it would be so sad to have done it. I would feel very bad about it.
Well, so there's the Louis C.K. joke of, yes, you know, everyone says they would go back and kill Hitler, but like at what age you go back and kill baby Hitler? You know, it's a baby. Yeah.
Right. Louis C.K. also says that he likes to ask people, would they rape Hitler?
That's right.
Let's not end on that note.
No.
What do you think happened with Elon Musk? I find him, you were friends with him. I find him a fascinating character. I read a couple of biographies of him, and I'm not one of these people who say, oh, what a moron he is, what a just lucky. And he, in some ways, I think he's plainly a man of extraordinary gifts.
Yeah.
But in some way, morally deranged and horrible life decisions.
Yeah, honestly, I think, again, I don't know how much of this was already kind of baked into his personality, and I just didn't detect it. Because again, when we were friends, he seemed, you know, granted, I didn't see him in what he was like as a boss, for instance, you know, firsthand. I was not in that context with him. I saw him, you know, I had like a peer-to-peer relationship with him. So he could have been treating employees horribly, and I just didn't know about it. But he always seemed like a very ethical person to me. I mean, he really, like, honestly, he did not seem like a person of marginal ethics when I was friends with him, but that completely unraveled at a certain point. And, you know, I think the unraveling more than anything was precipitated by his engagement with Twitter. I think he's totally addicted to Twitter. He's so addicted that he had to buy it so he could turn it into his, you know, private, you know, digital abattoir. And so, you know, he's like, in my view, he's patient zero for what social media can do to an otherwise productive person who has every opportunity to live a good life. I mean, he's just gotten weirder and more dishonest and more, his mind is more populated by, you know, conspiracy theories and just frank insanity. And he's been trained up by the algorithm.
Yeah.
To be this colossal maniac. And it's,
So it circles back to what we were talking about before, which is what would it be like to be surrounded, to be with companions who tell you you're never wrong, you're always funny, you're always right.
Yeah.
Your jokes are, in fact, Musk would often say when one of his jokes went humiliatingly wrong, he said, people around me thought it was very funny. Well, you know, they work for you.
Right. Yeah.
And so I wonder whether, you know, in a world where everybody has an AI companion, we're all going to end up like Elon Musk.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I think fame and wealth have not helped him, but I mean, he was already very famous and very wealthy, you know, when he was still kind of maintaining his altitude as a fairly normal person. Twitter, somewhere around 2018, 2019, his engagement, one saw a graph of his Twitter behavior, and it looks like, you know, he just doesn't even sleep, right? I mean, like, there's no time of day where he might not post on X, and that has increasingly been the case.
So how did Twitter make him crazy under your view? Is the idea that having this enormous audience led to this sort of extreme form of audience capture?
Yeah.
Where he began to be molded by the algorithm into this bizarre caricature.
And he became enamored of certain right-wing voices, his quality control. I mean, he has no, you know, though he's got endless resources and endless number of people wanting to save him from himself, presumably, his use of X appears to be totally unmediated. And so he's, you know, just in dialogue with neo-Nazis and anti-Semites and conspiracy lunatics. And he either doesn't know who these people are, or he doesn't care, or he knows and he likes them, but he's like, there's some version of that where he is the nexus of so much misinformation. So much is being directed to him and getting forwarded by him. Yeah, it's almost like a singularity for, you know, bad faith conversation about you know, any polarizing topic. And it was totally irresponsible. I mean, he's never wanted to take responsibility. That's where our falling out happened over this. I mean, he tweeted something idiotic about COVID that was obviously going to be consequential. And I tried to get him to walk it back. And then, you know, the wheels came off. So, yeah, live and learn.
Well, we'll see. Maybe maybe his apology letter is on its way.
Yes. One can imagine. The last one was go fuck yourself.
Got to be better than that.
It was go fuck yourself. Do your rebuttals on X, you fucking tool. It was one, go fuck yourself. Two, do your rebuttals on X, you fucking tool. Three, go fuck yourself. That was our last communication.
It's a sort of sandwich, but not a good one.
Yeah, the thing I was supposed to rebut was just a completely dishonest summary of something that I had said on my podcast. What he was doing, people would send him edited versions of clips from my podcast designed to make it seem like the opposite of what I said in context, right? And he would react to the clip because he doesn't have time to actually hear what I said in context. So he'd react to the clip. And when I pointed that out to him, that was his answer. So friendships, like many things, and really like everything that we encounter in this world, friendships are at least in principle impermanent, right? If you don't maintain them,
friendships at least with people.
Yeah.
But artificial companions are a whole different story.
Yeah. Yeah. They'll take you right to your deathbed. Well, let's not be those people, Paul. Let's try to keep it with human friends with all
with
their
savored and
their foibles.
While we both retain our consciousness and our humanity.
Yeah, yeah. Always great to talk to you, Paul. Thanks for
being
here.
Tons of fun, Sam.
Nice. Until next time.
Okay.